Welcome. This is Advisory. My name is Steve Crocker. I chair the committee. We have a mixture of committee people here, and I'm pleased to see plenty of others who are interested in what we're doing. At least I hope that's why you're here. And we have a reasonably packed agenda. So let me ask, let's put up the next slide. The first item is update on the registrant's guide to protecting domain name registration accounts. Dave Piscatello will be talking. Then an update on the ESSAC work party on orphaned name servers. And then an update on root scaling issues that Ram Mohan will talk about. And then I will talk about the bureaucratic issues of improving our processes that have resulted from the review process that's mandated by the bylaws and run through the ICANN board. And so with that, let me turn things over to Dave here.
Okay. Good morning. I'm going to give you a brief update on a work in progress. We have a working party of approximately 9 ESSAC members that represent a cross-section of registrars. We have registry representative and some people who are members of the security community at large and DNS operators, who are essentially doing a follow-on to and complement to SAC 40, which was a document that ESSAC published last year that described measures that registrars might take to protect domain name registrations against abuse. This document that we're working on now is actually a guide for registrants, those people who register domain names. And we are not focusing on any particular registrant. They could apply equally to an individual registrant as they could to a very large enterprise. Clearly, there are measures that would be more practical when applied to an enterprise, and we try to point that out. The origin of this work actually comes from a couple of sources. In fact, some of the comments that we received from registrars when we wrote the first document, SAC 40, indicated that we really should pay attention to the fact that to a certain extent, registrants have to protect their own assets and have to protect their own domain names just as much as they can rely on registrars to protect and provide measures to do so. So there are actually two parts of this document. I'll go into them in a little bit of detail. But one part is to provide best practices for registrants to follow to in-house or to protect their domains against misuse. And the second is to provide registrants with sufficient information for them to make informed decisions when they're choosing a registrar. Next slide, Julie. So the first part of the document, we have a draft that the committee is reviewing, essentially examines the threat landscape. And it looks at the same issues that SAC 40 looked at, but from the perspective of informing the registrant exactly what is at risk and what the potential attack vectors are. So we look at unauthorized access. We look at the malicious alteration of domain name service or name server configuration information, malicious alteration of contact information, unauthorized domain transfers and renewal issues, and try to explain again, as we have in several prior ESSAC reports, why these threaten an organization. Next slide, please. A second part of this section of the report tries to help registrants who are not familiar with such things as risk and business impact assessment with the risk that they incur when they leave their domain names unprotected. And in particular, Duncan Hart is helping us write a business impact assessment. This is the part of understanding and appreciating a domain name that often we've found in prior studies to be lacking among a lot of registrants. A registrant doesn't quite understand the value of the domain to either himself as an individual or to his organization until something's happened to it. the domain's been transferred out and they no longer have, you know, have that brand, or they have that, that online identity, or the, you know, the domain has been used in a malicious manner. It's been defaced in a web attack, or misused in some other malicious activity. Perhaps it's ended up hosting a phishing site, and all those have, you know, have some form of reputational harm associated with them. So, you know, we're attempting to provide that assessment for the potential registrant and reader of the document. We then go into some of the measures that you can take in-house. And, you know, arguably some of these are better suited for an organization that, you know, that has both, you know, manpower and understanding and appreciation for, you know, asset management. But the kinds of things that we talk about here can be implemented in relatively unsophisticated ways, or in you know, automated ways by a large organization. And the things that we talk about are how to protect account credentials that are used to access a registrant's login at a registrar, how to use the registrar correspondence registrars typically send to trigger an internal check or an action. So, for example, a renewal notice is often in one of the most common forms that a registrant will use to advise a registrant that his domain is about to expire. So why not use that as some internal workflow trigger that says, you know, we need to put a purchase order or a process in place to renew the domain. We also try to look at what I've called the hurricane box. Having lived in South Carolina and been in a situation where I've had to evacuate in anticipation of a hurricane, one of the things that we learned to do is to keep a box full of all our insurance documents, or the records that we have of ownership of various things that we're probably going to leave behind when we evacuate our home. Similarly, one of the things that is very valuable for a registrant to try to keep track of is some paper trail of ownership of domain, a printout of a whois. A receipt of the registration, correspondence you've received from the registrar, all sorts of things that you could use to provide or demonstrate that you were the owner of record or the registrant of record of a domain should you have a hijacking or some other event that affects your domain. Another aspect that we try to focus on is that the importance of accurate points of contact and of the kinds of identities that one uses in those points of contact. Many times, people will or registrations will have information of parties who were the original registrant for a domain when the company was five people, seven people. Now the company is a small to mid-cap or even a large enterprise, and the same name persists in the registration record. What is the risk of that, and what is the value of perhaps changing that to domain name administrator of, example.com? We also talk about implementing change controls across organizations, and providing some sort of link with the registrar correspondence in how one might use the triggers that a renewal notice that arise from a registrar to make certain that that different organizations within a larger organization are all informed and are advised of a change. So perhaps you have someone in corporate communications, or someone in legal, as well as someone who is in your web admin or your domain admin areas, all receiving notice and all making certain that changes are implemented. Next, please. Did you go to? No. Okay. Thank you. Another part of the practices that we want to try to recommend is not only to have this sort of constant or attention to the documentation that you have and the registration information that you maintain, but also to try to do something proactive in the way of monitoring to have at least a timely understanding or notice of a change. and to be able to distinguish whether that change was one that was authorized and one that, that perhaps is an indication of an attack. So in the same way that people, you know, have used things like SNMP and ping to touch a machine to see if it's up and running, some of the things that you can do with WHOIS and DNS in relatively low frequency monitoring is to go and grab the WHOIS record or go and grab the DNS information that's associated with your domains and compare against what you know to be the correct configuration to make certain that, or the correct WHOIS information, to make certain that there haven't been unauthorized changes. The final part of the document, thus far, and we may extend it to look at some other issues, is to try to ask to provide registrants with some questions to ask prospective registrars. There are choices to be made. There are a number of different registrars, and they offer different services, and they offer different security measures. And if you know the kinds of questions to ask, just as you would a vendor if you were buying routing equipment or telecom equipment, you probably have have a better chance of making an informed choice among the large number of registrars out there. So I've grouped the questions that we currently ask into four main categories. These are roughly correspond to what we've done so far. But one set is account management features. What kinds of login mechanisms do you have? What kinds of protective measures do you have against unauthorized access? What kinds of features do you have in your account management? Am I able to change, and do I receive a notice when I make changes? How quickly my changes get put in place and the like. The second plays to that whole issue that we raised earlier about using a registrar's routine correspondence. One of the things you might want to ask is, can you enumerate the correspondence that we should typically expect? So number one, I know what to expect, and number two, when I see something that is outside the five or six messages that I typically expect, I can immediately view them as suspicious and the potential for registrar impersonation or a phishing attack. The third is just a general set of questions aimed at the kinds of security measures and the kinds of abuse management that that the registrar actually implements. And the last is what basically almost any good organization is going to ask a potential business partner, and that's really what a registrar is. Can you give me some information that helps me understand your reputation in the industry? What's your track record, with ICANN and compliance? What other references of organizations of like size to mine, can you provide me to make me feel comfortable that that I'm actually going to engage in a relationship with a business partner that can meet my needs? That's it. We're hoping that we will be able to come to Cartagena in the fourth quarter and have a document ready for or published and ready for consumption. If there are other things that you would like to have us take a look at or other questions you have now, I'm perfectly happy to entertain them.
Dave, hi, Simon from Nominet. What's the plan for getting this? I mean, it's fantastic, this. What's the plan for getting this into the awareness of registrants, getting it out there so people know it exists?
We're going to spam it. I've talked with the people who operate Zeus, and they're actually going to help us.
We've registered 250 names in every domain.
I think that that's a really, really valuable question. The normal processes that we have is that we make an announcement, we put the announcement on the public announcement page at the SAC site. In this particular case, what I probably would try to do is reach out to the various ACs and SOs and see if there are other venues that we might be able to make it public, because it is, in fact, a different orientation. It's a consumption document on a much, much broader scale than the typical ICANN document. So if you have ideas about how we could reach out, love to hear them either now or if you could drop me some email, because the broader the reach on this particular document, I think the more impact.
Certainly, I know we and a number of other registries are doing a kind of know the net kind of initiative, and I think this would tailor into that really very well.
Terrific. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, I heard one.
We also translate our reports into other languages, yeah. And so we'll translate into registries, registraries, ISPEs, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. That's some Vanda Scartesini from the board, and I'm a ALAC liaison, and just because of that. My suggestion is really take it as a task for ALAC to promote, because there is something that the RALOs can distribute to the ALS, and the ALS can distribute in each country, and this in each language, and this goes much further than if you just post it in some place, because people don't go, don't read, don't assess, have difficulties, and so on. So that's my suggestion, that we get together and put this as a task for ALAC to reach the people around the world.
That's a great idea. And one of the things that I would really love to hear from ALAC is what languages we should translate it into beyond the five languages that we normally translate ESSAC documents. So to make certain that we're actually reaching the audiences that you see are most interested in the kinds of documentation that we publish, you know, that feedback would be helpful as well. Patrick.
Let me just take a moment to welcome Vanda. I've had the pleasure of working with Vanda earlier when she was on the board, and now she's back on the board as the ALAC representative, and one of the sharpest minds that I've encountered in this environment, and it's been a real pleasure. And so I've been delighted that she's been interested in what we're doing. And as I said a few words on your behalf, Vanda, when before bringing a lot of scope in multiple dimensions to us. So anyway, welcome, and I'm very pleased that you're with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Patrick Fanuel from the ALAC too. Obviously, I totally support what Vanda just said and wanted to point out that indeed, from the ALAC perspective, it's important that registrants can make an informed choice when choosing a registrar. All these comments you presented are obviously mainly technical in the sense that this is the main focus of ESSAC. Still, there are other aspects. You briefly mentioned reputation, and I think it's an important aspect in the sense that in the registrar business, when choosing a registrar, most of the time people go for the lowest price rather than going for the best reputation, if only for the fact that there are so many registrars, often very physically remote to the to the registrant. You can be a registrant in Europe and have your domain name registered with a registrar in Canada, for example, and it's often difficult to check the reputation of a registrar on the other side of the world. It's much easier if you're working with local companies, of course. This is why I'm wondering if there will be some possibility to have kind of objective benchmarks on which registrars are reputable, which are less, and I think especially coming from the compliance department from ICANN, we have seen over time that some registrars behave more ethically than others, especially regarding how they manage phishing and things like that. So I think it would be helpful to have clear benchmarks that people can refer to without going through pages and pages of obscure reports to if they're only interested in a small part. I would also like to mention that at the same time, the ALAC is working on something which is close to what you mentioned, and that is the a working group on registrant rights. What can a registrant expect as a service from a registrar? Security is one part of it. But there are other aspects, like what's the registrar's policy for transferring domains and things like that. I think might be useful to have a document which could integrate all these aspects. Now, the work that the ALAC is doing on the registrant rights is mostly linked to the registrar agreement being discussed, so it's also work in progress. I'm not sure that they will come up with a proposal in time for the Cartagena meeting, but I think we have to keep in mind that besides the excellent work that you have been doing on this from the security side, there are other aspects that the registrant should also be aware of. And as Van, just like Vanda said, I think that the ALAC could be an excellent partner to disseminate the information among more general audience. You asked for which languages it should be written in, and I would say first and foremost, write it in plain language. Write it in plain language, in non-technical language, because most of the registrants do not understand much about that, and they need something they can understand on first reading without going through hundreds of web pages and Wikipedia entries to understand what it's all about. Besides the five languages that I can use, I can nothing on the top of my head which ones should be could be useful. I would mention German, for example, because it's a large country, and they have a very active internet community, so that might be helpful to add German to the list. But that's just my what I can think about on the top of my head. Thank you.
Thank you, Rod Rasmussen, Internet Identity. I have a few comments, and I think many of you know that this has been a crusade of mine for the last several years in the Anti-Phishing Working Group, and we will definitely be disseminating this widely from that perspective. I've got a commercial interest as well. It's actually monitoring this kind of thing in my company. But a couple of things that are, I think, important to put out there is that one is there are now registry-level services that actually help with this as well, as VeriSign has launched a registry lock. And I would encourage other registries to consider such levels of protection as well, especially ccTLD registries. We saw recent hijackings in just last week of Microsoft and Coca-Cola in Israel. Their domain names were taken over by Turkish hackers who had a political message to deliver. So this kind of behavior continues to be rather rampant, a lot of hijackings lately. So this kind of information is important to get out there. Another thing I would point out further the comments from ALAC is that a lot of the people in charge of managing the domain name portfolios for companies are trademark or marketing people. They are not technical people at all. So plain language is clearly needed in that field. I just wanted to echo that sentiment as well.
Okay. Thank you all for that. I think we should probably move on because we have a tight agenda and we're halfway through our time. Thank you again for the very, very strong feedback.
Yes. Orphan name server work update, Jim Galvin.
Thank you, Steve. By way of introduction, let me offer that this is not an area that most people would pay attention to and isn't really visible to the average user as compared to the work that we were just listening to, which everyone should be familiar with or pay attention to. This is something that matters more to operators, in particular registry operators, and to forensic activities. I'm sure that Rod has his opinions about orphan name servers and what happens. The second thing to offer is that this is a work in progress, just as the previous work was, so we have some preliminary things to say here, but there's still some work to be done. So next, Julie. One of the first questions that came up in dealing with this issue was, what exactly is an orphaned record? There are some words that have been used before in previous presentations. There is some references in the draft applicant guidebook that speaks to what an orphaned name server is and an orphaned record in the system. And one of the questions that immediately comes up when you look at this from an operational point of view is, what happens if the name exists in the registry but not in the zone? So the visible part of what is an orphaned name server is looking only in the zone file, and then it's pretty apparent. However, there are circumstances under which a name would exist in the registry but not be in the zone file. And so the question that is before us that we don't have a consensus on yet, even in our work party, is whether or not this is an orphaned record. And if it is, what does that mean? But how could you verify it? I mean, this becomes important in the draft applicant guidebook, the guidelines for new TLDs and presumably for existing TLDs eventually. This issue of, how do you manage this? And there's no way to do that externally. So it's just an internal issue. So next slide. So what we set out to do was to measure the size of the problem. A straightforward thing to do would be to grab the zone files that you have access to. Since we're working with an ICANN staff member, Steve Shang really is the guy who did all of this work for us. He was able to look at the copies of zone files that ICANN has access to for the GTLDs and go through these and look to see if he could find orphan name records just in the zone, just looking at the zone file definition. All right, so for a domain name that used a name server, just look if that name server, if its particular parent existed somewhere else in one of the GTLDs. Next slide. So using that zone file definition, all right, we have some empirical early results. So we took a sample set from May 16th of zone files from 11 GTLDs, and we created some databases from those three, from all of those zone files, three tables. We collected a table of everything which was a GLU record, a table of all of the domain records, and then a table of the name server, domain name server records. And then we went through and counted all the entries in those GLU records, okay, looking for GLU records that did not have a parent domain that existed anywhere else. One of the things that we also got from this was, because we collected all of the GTLDs together, we were able to easily see across TLDs whether or not a domain existed or not in the zone files. So if you are in onedomain.com is probably the most obvious example, being the largest and most popular, you might have domains in other TLDs that would use name servers in the .com domain. Okay. Next slide. So these are just some initial numbers for things to consider. Looking again only at that zone file definition of a GLU record, you can see up here that actually the percentage of orphaned name server records is really pretty small. In the grand scheme of things. Only 20,000 orphan name servers, which accounts for less than 1% of all the GLU records across the 11 GTLDs. The percentage does range, actually, it's quite a broad range, even though 0.8% is the total amount. The number of name servers that were orphaned range from none to a little over 6%, okay, with the median being around 1.5%. So it's a pretty broad range, but again, even the median is pretty small. So for the most part, there's not a whole lot of orphan GLU records out there. And the other number that we have up there is the 43,000, and that's the number of domains that are using these records that were identified as orphan glue records. Right? So the number of domains that actually made reference to a name server that was not defined, did not have a parent that existed in the zone files. Next slide. And moving on. So we took these 53,000 domains and decided to take a look at one of the things that we're trying to explore is to what extent these domains are used for nefarious purposes. So the first approach that we have here that we looked at was to see if these domains are listed in spam blacklists. It was an easy thing to check, easy thing to automate, so it was a quick statistic that we could go and grab very easily. These are the two spam lists that we looked at, and you know, some stats there, they have pretty broad coverage and tend to be, the industry tends to accept them as having a pretty low false positive rate. Okay. Next slide. And these are just some early results. Not really entirely sure what that means, and I think that's really one of the open questions that's facing the work group, is trying to decide how to interpret this data, I mean, what it really means, and what other ways in which we might check some of these domain names to see if they're being used for nefarious purposes. I mean, ultimately what we're trying to find is some empirical evidence about the extent to which orphan name servers are used for nefarious purposes. That's really the question that we're trying to look at. And this is just one indicator in looking at domains using orphan name servers. 31% listed in Spamhaus, 28% listed on the CIRL multi-domain blacklist. I think one of the questions that we have asked ourselves is, one of the issues is these backlists are a moment in time, and what we'd really like to do is be able to look at the history, like be able to take these domains and track back over history how often they've been on these lists or not been on the lists, were the names created, how long ago they were created, how long they've existed, and how long they've changed. Have they been on the list and off the list? Or is it just a recent activity that got them off the list? So the problem with looking at the blacklists, again, is that they are a moment in time, and that's not necessarily representative of the status of that particular domain. So whereas the 31% and 28% look like fairly high negative indicators of these domains, we're not really sure what that means. And so that's a place in which we are still looking. And in fact, we're also still looking for other ways in which we might evaluate these domains that have these orphan name servers. So we're very interested in any suggestions that people have about how we might also look at these domains and other ways in which we might evaluate them. So, and again, just going back to what I started with, one of the critical open questions that we have for ourselves is trying to decide what exactly is an orphan name server and what that really means. There's an obvious working definition, an obvious visible definition in simply evaluating the data in a zone file, but that's not the only indicator. There's also, you know, back-end data, which is not normally visible to people, which is whether a domain exists in the registry or not, in a registry database, and that's important. So, next slide. And I think that's it, right? So, we're looking, obviously, to finish this work, and we're hoping to finish it soon. One of the things that we want to do in addition to the empirical evidence that we have, a little bit of facts, is we want to continue to study those facts and come up with some questions to ask ourselves about how to evaluate those domains and the numbers that we have here. We also want to do a study with some other GTLDs. We want to ask some folks and try to do a little survey about what people are doing today about their orphan name servers, if anything, and how they deal with it. And any problems that they've encountered in removing them, what issues exist. Many of the TLDs we know do actually have business rules in place to prevent the existence of orphan name servers, and yet there are cases where they still exist in the zone, and so an interesting question that comes up is, you know, why are they there, and what makes them appear? And so we want to try to get at answering that particular question, again, so that we can better understand our data and have something useful to contribute to this process, especially in consideration of the fact that the draft applicant guidebook, one of the requirements being put forth in dealing with malicious conduct is to prevent orphan name servers. So it's important to understand what they are and also the motivation for why they need to be prevented. And I think that's it, yes. Thank you. And I'll take any questions or comments.
Thank you, Jim. This is excellent work. The APWG would be happy to supplement the information, obviously, to look at those domains that you've put in the study. One of the things that I think would also be helpful would be to take a look at the status of the domain at the registry, if it's on hold or not, because it could still be. That's typically what a registrar or registry does when they suspend a domain name for abuse. Is they leave it in the registry if it's past 5 days, but put in a suspended status. So you could probably do a survey of the registrars involved and find out what exactly put them in there. It was 53,000 domains, though, so it might be a little challenging. But we'd be happy to help with that, too, at the APWG.
This was a report from a work party in our parlance. Say something about the anticipated schedule of bringing this out and moving it through our whole process.
Let me first thank Rod for his offer to help us evaluate some of these things, and I think you've well, thank you, and we'll certainly follow up on that. I don't know that I'm prepared to commit to a schedule. I mean, in terms of the process, one of the things that we have to do is it is coming out of a work party. So from an ESSEC process point of view, the first thing that has to happen is it comes to the full committee for an evaluation too, and we have to work that process and get comments from the full committee. Since it is going to represent an ESSEC position, everyone gets an opportunity to review the work and then publish it. We don't actually have a schedule right now for Steve will be the one who will be doing the research on interviewing the GTLDs, and we have not set a deadline for completing that.
Steve so, Shang we're talking about.
Yeah, Steve Shang. Yes, I'm sorry. Should be clear about that. And so I just have to say that we just don't have that plan, so I don't have a date to commit to you. I mean, in general, I think it's fair to say I'm looking around here at the couple of us who are where's Matt? I would think he was here too, and Roy's over there. I think soon is the right answer. Soonish, yeah. That we certainly want to get a draft report together, but we are gated by when we can get these interviews done, and that in itself is its own challenging process. So,
any other comments? Any other questions, Rob?
I guess I didn't understand exactly what Rod was talking about. Something. I heard you say something about deletions and suspensions, but I didn't actually understand the thrust of your comments as regards to orphan DNS.
Right. So I was just saying that the response that a lot of registrars have when they get an abuse complaint about a domain name is to keep the domain in the registry. So it's actually in the registry, but they suspend it. So there's not an actual physical zone file entry for that domain name because it's not published. However, the name servers continue to be published if they're supporting other domain names. So one of the things to take a look at would be what is the status of the domain? Is it on registrar hold or is it on some sort of hold status? And that's actually something that can be enumerated fairly easily automatically. So you can take a look at that versus is it registered and there's no you can't really see a hold status or something like that.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies it. I guess my concern there is a registrar can simply delete a name from their zone file without placing it on hold. Right. So I'm not certain you will actually get a complete picture of what you're trying to
write. Yeah, no, I don't expect a complete picture, but it can give you some information on an automated basis because you're looking at 53,000 here. So I'm just looking at ways of doing that easily to get some demographics, and the rest of them you'd have to go and do more thorough investigation of.
I think one of the points that Rod is making that's valuable is that there's multiple dimensions to characterizing an orphan. So it's almost like there are different kinds of orphans, and it would be useful for us to try to understand from registrars and from registries and from from the anti-malware, anti-phishing community what the characteristics are that, you know, so that we can come up with a common understanding of how to classify them and which ones, you know, which ones merit attention and which ones don't.
One more quick point is that one of the ways you get an orphan too is from expiration, right? So somebody doesn't renew their domain name by mistake or something like that. So that's another thing to take a look at is which ones are in the grace period, for example, and it's just simply a mistake. And you can take a look at registration dates as well as to how to classify those.
Just to follow up, then what that draws me is a question to the work party. Does that mean that do you have a plan to arrive at some set of recommendations that may perhaps include things like different statuses being shown in who is that may drive changes into the registry or registrar contracts? I mean, what is the intended outcome after you complete the study? What change in the ecosystem do you want to achieve?
Right, and to speak to what changes we want, the issue there is deciding first what is an orphaned record and or what are the various categories and types. That's one of the first things that popped up in our discussions. All of the circumstances that Rod is identifying, we actually had identified to ourselves. There are different ways in which things become orphaned, and a fair question to ask is, does that make them really orphaned? And do we need rules that eliminate those circumstances? So you talk about if you're going to take down a domain, one of the ways in which you might take it down, if that action is going to be taken, whether by a registry or a registrar, is you first change the status. You put it on hold. And the advantage of that is it takes that out of the zone file, so it makes it inaccessible. That, of course, leaves orphaned records around if you're only leaving the if you're only removing, if you don't remove the name server records along with the domain. So that would be a business rule change that goes with doing that. If you change the status, you also have to take those subordinate records out. The thing that I really wanted to emphasize in all of this is one of the things that we've discovered is there are categories of orphan name server records of what they really are. And the second thing to understand is even the data that we have here is a moment in time. And so one of the critical things is understanding what made something an orphan or didn't make it an orphan, and that's more data than the moment in time. You have to go back and look at the status changes. You have to look at why these records are orphaned. Was their parent zone simply something that was put in a particular status? And why it got into that status. And that's more information than is immediately visible, and it takes some amount of research to figure that out.
I guess my encouragement is to then, once this piece is completed, is to not conclude the work party, but to actually drive it to specific things that can be done. Because I think if you want to do something, ESSAC has the ability to address and move some of these things along. So the work party, I would encourage the work party to continue down that path.
Maybe just to close this, I mean, the original intent of looking into orphans was to try to distinguish malignancy from something that's benign, and I think we're still trying to understand, you know, how we characterize an orphan beyond what the words that we already have in the DAG and the words that are in prior presentations, so that we're focusing primarily on a domain that is potentially malignant, like the noise here, and have some action that all the registries could agree to take, because the goal is not to have those kinds of records in any of the registries. There are some other issues that you could probably say about what we currently have as the broad set of orphans is that, you know, some of them may be just simply operationally clumsy. There's just pieces of information that shouldn't be lying around because if you're a neat and tidy person, obsessive compulsive or whatever, that you don't want them in your zone. I don't want to go making policy about something like that, because that's just may make work for somebody. But the ones that are I think for me that can be used for criminal or malicious activity, the ones we really want to try to pinpoint. And getting that definition right is the hard part for this group to actually accomplish Once we do that, I don't think that, it's going to be quite as hard for us to put specific recommendations in place for how to remove it, because I think that there would be a general community consensus that, yeah, we don't want these around if they're going to be hurting people.
First of all, are there any questions for those who are on the telephone? From those who are on the telephone, and do we have any questions from the chat room?
No, we don't. Yeah, not from the ESSEC chat room, but I'm not looking at the WebEx chat room.
Nothing from the WebEx chat.
Okay, so we're good. Anyway, thank you very much for all the comments, and we're certainly, it's a work in progress, and we know that there's still some a lot to be done to understand what we're doing, as well as just conducting the actual interviews and getting more data. So thank you.
Rom.
Thank you. This is an update on root scaling issues, something that ESSEC has been engaged on for a little while. Just by way of quick background, and I'm not going to read everything that's up on the screen there, but this has been work that began in February of 2009 and is continuing. And we're hopeful that at least a first phase of this work will conclude sometime soon. On the next slide, there were four real issues, and you, those here on the in the room perhaps cannot see what's on the the things that are in different colors. Black on the top is Anycast server location. That's a new issue. But the red is adding IPv6 records, and it seems, at least in the discussions, that that seems to have small impact. IDNs, which is in purple on further to the right on the clockwise direction. The general summary seems to be that it seems to be like new TLDs, but there are some special issues that arise as a result of introducing IDNs into the root. New TLDs themselves, one of the which is a green, one of the things that seems to have emerged is that the level of concern seems to be related, among other things, but certainly strongly correlated to the rate of change in terms of new TLDs. And blue on the left, certainly signing the root, DNSSEC, that is certainly a big change. On the next slide, speaking more strongly towards DNSSEC, as you all know, that's a pretty big change. The signing of the root is underway. It's anticipated in full to be in full operation next month. And clearly a lot of testing is in progress. Many measures have been taken, and at this point it doesn't look like something bad has happened. It seems to be moving along smoothly. So kind of a summarization of what I will characterize as kind of sense of ESSEC. It's not yet something that we've polled or got consensus from the membership, but what I characterize as sense of ESSEC is that if it continues, the DNSSEC deployment and the signing of the root, if that process continues smoothly, we're probably in good shape as far as the root is concerned. Next slide is on new TLDs. As I mentioned briefly before, it seems to be most tightly correlated to the rate of change. The big question that has come up in several discussions inside of ESSEC is, will the addition of new TLDs overwhelm any part of the root server system? And if so, how many new TLDs? Is there a number? Is there a range? And how soon, when will it, if there is a particular range, then, when, if it will, when will it overwhelm it? And how will we know that the root server system is being overwhelmed? Those are the kinds of questions that have been debated and discussed at great length inside of ESSEC. ICANN itself has published reports that indicate that it is ramping up its own capacity to evaluate and approve new TLDs, and they've indicated an upper limit of 924 new TLDs a year and potentially more after the introduction of the new gTLD program. But at least from our discussions and deliberations inside of SAC, it's pretty clear that neither the legal department from within ICANN nor the board or the U.S. government can accommodate that many contract actions and considerations. So there is clearly a bound on the rate of introduction right there that has got nothing to do with technology or technical factors. And, you know, can the root server operators accommodate that many new TLDs, you know, in a year's time or in some given period of time? Discussions indicate probably yes, but further discussions seem to clarify that the answer is it depends on the rate of change. You know, how soon, it's not how many, it's how many at what rate. Next slide is on IDN TLDs. The way our discussion has gone on, it seems to indicate that these are really should be treated like new TLDs themselves. But there are some special situations. As has already been demonstrated, there are several IDN TLDs that have already been added to the route. From Nairobi to now, things have moved on, and there have been no reported problems and no new risks that have come up, which is consistent with what SAC's own thinking was and discussions were earlier in the year. So the actual process of adding an IDN TLD to the root zone is no different than adding a non-IDN TLD. And the procedures from IANA and the delegation mechanisms remain pretty identical there. The only exception that seems to exist is when there are requests for IDN TLD variants to also be delegated to the root zone. At the same time, a primary IDN TLD is being requested. And at least the preliminary indications are neither technical nor operational issues have actually been flushed out, and they remain. There's kind of two segments to this. One is a lack of clarity as to what exactly are all of the technical and operational issues, and then secondly, how do you actually ensure if there are methods that can ensure that variants point to the same locations. There is seems to be a desire that you know, the locations ought to be the same, but there are really no good steps to ensure that that happens. However, it seems clear that these issues can be separable from scaling itself. So it may not be a scaling issue, but a wrong approach to how variants get delegated and how methods are created or enforced or you know, promoted into the ICANN community can cause stability problems. The last area here is IPv6 records. It's business as usual. There's really nothing much to report. Next slide. A new issue that came up that we've first reported on in Nairobi and that continues to remain an issue is the location of Anycast servers. What's come to notice is that there's a possibility that remote location of Anycast instances of the root might inhibit the growth of the root zone. It was not previously explicit in discussions, and root server operators themselves have not spoken clearly or explicitly on this. Some of them say this is no big deal. This is not a problem. Just move on. But it's not. There is not a clear statement or clear perspective that have come out from the root server operators. Clearly, what's needed is some straightforward discussion with them and to ask them to speak as a unit and not just in an individual capacity. So, moving on, status and conclusions. One thing that has been extremely clear from SAC interactions are that the two published reports, the RSST report as well as the TNO report, either taken individually or in conjunction with each other, are insufficient to conclude the root scaling study. And there are
again, as mentioned in the previous slide, several issues that may impact have arisen. What's clear, therefore, is that further work may not be required to start new TLD delegations. In other words, you may not require new work before new TLD delegations may actually, you know, start to happen. However, it looks likely that new work could be required to continue new TLD delegations once that work gets started. On the next slide, we're shooting for a third quarter 2010 kind of a report that comes out from SSAC, which will clearly take into account the fact that the problem space that we were considering in 2009 February is now far more tightly bounded. By the time we come out of the report, the route would have been signed, ID and TLDs would have gone into production. So that experience that has been gained by the DNSSEC implementations would certainly be considered. And the other thing is that, if you look at the original report published last year, there were considerations and thought processes that were based on 10,000 or 100,000 new TLDs being added into the root zone. What's clear is that those are more theoretical in nature, and reality is that the upper bound is not limited by technology or operational problems. The upper bound seems to be much more limited by just contractual and other procedural matters that ICANN has to work through. The other hope is to, or plan is to initiate root scaling study of version 2 off it in this next quarter coming up. And to initiate an end-user impact study in the fourth quarter. The end-user impact study, some of you may recall, was a work item that was explicitly identified as something that had to be done in the first deliberations, in the first root-scaling study meeting of SSAC, but it was set aside as something that had to be done later. And that, has to get teed up. So in summary, gap analysis work that has already begun, that needs to be concluded. That is an important work item. A basic paper that presents what we have found and agreed upon so far, that is due. And I have to let both SSAC members as well as the open community, the general community, know that the ICANN board is eagerly awaiting this work output. It's been made quite clear by the board that this is this is important work, and that they depend upon SSAC as well as RSAC to provide clear and unambiguous input and provide a report that helps inform their decision making when it comes, especially with regard to the rollout of new TLDs. And as mentioned there, studies 2 and 3, they need scope definition as well as, input from SSAC members in terms of what the scope and what the remit of those studies ought to be. One thing that I'll leave you with is it is clear that we are not yet able to provide a single clear message that says, that declares, all is safe, ICANN can proceed with new GTLDs without worrying about any of these factors. We're not there yet. At the same time, we're not able to say either, stop everything. There are major problems that you need to be worried about. So that's, if you want to summarize where we are at, we're in that spot. We will also put forth a first cut at the parameters to measure and thresholds to consider. This need not be 100% accurate, so long as it's reasonably good and starts to, stimulate more detailed discussion. So input to the board is required, is anticipated, and seems to be a one of the significant priorities, if you will, that has to happen. Especially the board is looking for, do they need to come to a full stop on any of the four areas under study? They'd like some indication of that. They would certainly like to hear SSAC declare an all clear, but at the same time, they understand if you're not able to do that. And they certainly seem to be willing and able to figure out, to actually listen to the need for study, you know, the root scaling study version 2, as well as the end user impact study, and then, you know, listen to SSAC's input in terms of the scope of it and, you know, the way to make that go forward. Thanks. Questions? Back to you.
Are there any questions from those on the telephone? Are there any questions in the chat room?
No questions in the chat room.
Thank you.
I guess now it's my turn, right? Okay. The ICANN bylaws mandate a review process on a kind of rolling basis across the entire organization, the board, the nominating committee, each of the supporting organizations, each of the advisory committees. I forget exactly when this process was started, but it was started with a review, GNSO, and then ALAC, I think, and so forth. And we were... 2007. Thank you, Vonda. We were put in sort of in the middle of the pack, if I recall correctly. The way these things work, for anybody who hasn't been tracking this closely or doesn't remember, is that terms of reference are put together. There's a solicitation for an external reviewer. A reviewer is selected, and then the external reviewer does their work and prepares a report. This work is overseen by a subcommittee of the board, composed of board members and sometimes retired prior board members, who then take that report from the consultant and conduct their own examination of whether it's complete and get other opinions. In our particular case, we did an internal assessment following the external assessment, and we provided that information to that board committee as well as to the public in general. And then the board committee makes a recommendation, and then that, depending upon what's in the recommendation, those actions come out of there. We're very close to the tail end of the process, and the outputs from that are that the SAC should maintain its fundamental identity as an advisory committee. That was one of the key questions. We were created at a very early point in time in the ICANN history, and a natural question to ask was sort of the fundamental one. Do we still serve a purpose? Is the context changed enough that we should start over and so forth? And I'll say from my point of view, I thought that was a very important kind of question. I pushed it very hard. I was fully prepared for rather dramatic changes. Nobody else seemed to be as interested, and we have become too successful for anybody to want to make any change to it. They say, oh, just keep it the way it is, more or less. We've undertaken... And then, among other things, a number of other smaller recommendations came out, many of which we have incorporated already and begun to accommodate to. So one of these was to undertake a lightweight planning process to determine the research and publication agenda. We should improve our openness with publishing minutes, not detailed transcripts particularly, on the but minutes of our meetings on the SAC website in a timely manner. Our website, the portion of the website that we maintain, had become somewhat stale and out of date, and so that was noted. Although I'll note that we originally took the initiative in creating all of this, so we deserve exactly the kind of review that we got, but I think the basic idea of what we were doing was very good. There was a point made that our members ought to be appointed for a fixed period of time. with 3 years being the nominal period recommended, and that could be renewable. So a piece of history here is that when FSAC was created, the charter said that the members are appointed by the board, and that's the only language that's in there with respect to membership. There's nothing about term limits, nothing about removal, nothing about any criteria or anything like that. Vint Cerf invited me to chair the committee, get it started, and just, take me 6 months, as he said, and I knew at the moment he said it that it was an underestimate by a little bit. So we've been at this a little over 8 years, which I think means that I'm just completely inefficient at getting the job done. But along the way, I've taken a very pragmatic and low-key and informal approach with respect to memberships, paying attention to people who have become inactive and sometimes having a private conversation, which has usually led to the member deciding that it's time it's come to drop off and sending a note of resignation, and then we formally thank the person and make it all as positive experience as we can, particularly since this is a volunteer effort and it's behalf of the community, so there's no reason to be negative at all. This shift in going to three-year terms will require a formal change to the rules. That means a bylaw change, which triggers a formal process of posting changes and having the board approve it and a public comment period and so forth. All of the other recommendations are ones that we've been able to accommodate or, in fact, that we initiated on our own changes to our own activity. Yes, so we've moved on to the next slide. There's some key things here. One of the topics that was spent the review process spent a lot of time on was confidentiality. As everybody has seen, we endeavored to publish our reports, make them widely available. The counter side of that is whether or not we should be delving into matters that require confidentiality and whether we have the machinery to do that. The outcome of all of that is that we should, in fact, adopt a default confidentiality process so that our internal deliberations are private to ourselves, but that we continue to publish as much as we can, and that on occasion when we need to delve into something that requires a higher degree of care, that we may require specific agreements from the members who are involved in a particular study. And we may, in fact, not publish the results publicly, but we may publish them privately to the parties involved or just to the board. We've also developed a more explicit conflict of interest policy and made differences of opinion more visible, either because of conflicts of opinion, conflicts of interest, or because of minority opinions or just contrary opinions. So all of this you've actually seen adopted over the past year or so. Another activity which has been a long time in coming and is nearing fruition is writing down just in a very pragmatic way the procedures that we have evolved among for ourselves over a period of time. So we have a document which I very carefully don't call a policy document. It's a operational procedures document. And it's attempting to record for whoever has to pick up the threads here and make things go, just the history of how we do things, the publication process, the meetings process, a lot of mechanical details. And Julie has been putting this together. I've been reviewing it line by line, editing it, and the next step will be to share it with the full committee. And so that's where we are. So getting back to the membership thing, because this is going to trigger two visible actions. One is submission to the board, which we're doing this week, of a requested bylaw change. The expected action is that they will adopt this as a action to take under consideration, and the first thing is to post it for public comment. And then if that goes through smoothly, then that will adopt a change. The next is that if we do have 3-year terms, then the question is what happens to all of the people who are currently on the board, I mean currently on the committee here. I have drafted an assignment of people into terms that end in a year, in 2 years, and in 3 years in order to get the spread of sort of equal, more or less equal spread. I haven't sent this around yet, but I will. But the basic scheme is that people who've been around for a very long time get the shortest terms, and people who are relatively new get the longest terms. These terms are renewable. There's not any intent to do any more than just take advantage of the fact that we have a lot of baseline knowledge of the people who've been on the committee for a long time. And then there's I'm not sure it's a perfect match with that, but that's the predominant structure. And as I say, there's nothing that forces anything. It just changes the bias from you're on forever until somebody takes some action to setting a time when the conversation has to take place and an explicit action to renew has to take place. And that will have, I think, the appropriate effect. At least we can try that for some period of time and then there's always room to make more changes. Have I covered everything that's on here? I'm doing some of this in response to these notes. I think so. And so thank you. Any questions? Have I managed to put everybody to sleep with these excellent procedural changes? I know this is a hot-button issue for everybody. Audience, anybody? Chat room? Vonda, please.
Yeah. Just... we passed through this in the, I have participated in the GNSO review, and after that we passed through this with the ALAC. And one thing that I believe it's quite important, and it was important for our organization as a group, was a kind of roadmap that the staff made for us. So it's better than in the board. The board has less is now less organized than the ALAC. And the roadmap to implement all the things and to give you an overview what you're going to have during the whole year gives a sensation of, of a task to do and to how to organize, and it's much more easy to publish anything that you want to under this roadmap. So I may suggest the staff that helps you here could do this for just help all the others to follow up what is to be done, what is already done, what is the time that you expected to finish and so on. And this makes it much easier for any member to follow and to join and get out of any of those initiatives that you have here. It's just a suggestion, and the staff can do this for...
So I've been hearing very good things, in fact, about the ALAC plan roadmap, and am eager to see that, and I think we ought to benefit from that. One of the things that I think is a strength in the ICANN structure is that by having multiple groups, we can independently work on our various issues, and then watch each other, compare each other, learn from each other. So I'm happy for anything that we do that informs, that becomes helpful to any other group. And equally, as in this case, if we see something particularly well done in another group, that we should be shameless about copying it or examining it and making use of it. I like that. In fact, Yeah, exchange. In fact, I'll take a minute to emphasize this point in a slightly different context and go off the road here. One of the things that I think is important in the top-level domain space is the split between ccTLDs and gTLDs. I hear lament from time to time, complaints that the original structure was supposed to bring all of the TLDs under one umbrella with a kind of uniform contractual structure or whatever. After hanging around for in this environment for a while, I actually find that the ccTLD independence is more of a strength than a weakness, and that the diversity and independence is enormously helpful in keeping our heads on straight about what's important and what isn't important and how to cut through some problems. And so I think just, you know, sort of I'm abstracting from the small point that we're dealing with about our procedural processes internally and abstracting it to a much larger point, but I think it's a healthy to have this kind of diversity. And so anyway, coming back to ALAC, can please convey both Patrick and Vonda our respect and admiration for the excellent progress that ALAC has made over the years. I know it's been a tough, long road from early days, and ALAC has grown into a robust and quite respected organization, and so that's good. And the rest of this we'll do offline in getting a copy of your roadmap and studying it and all of that. Julie?
I just wanted to mention for the benefit of those who may not be familiar with some of the new things we already have in place. And if you check on the ESSAC website, the public site, we do publish our work plan. The work plan lists the various areas of work for the year and also the timelines for completion. These are published on the website under work plans. There will be a semi-annual review of that plan and update on our status on these work items. In addition, we publish the activities that take place at the ICANN meetings so that someone can see what has happened and you know, get a sense of how the work is progressing through our meetings at ICANN. And we have internal reports that track the outcomes from those meetings that then feed into our work plans.
Thank you. Let me take this opportunity. I think we're at the end of this meeting. Let me take this opportunity to thank everyone, committee members and staff, for enormous amount of work that has been done and the output that we've been able to create. As we've seen from the feedback from the law enforcement community, from and from the from Greg Rattray on the internal processes in ICANN, the work that we've done a while ago has continued to have substantial and noticeable impact. And in fact, one of the things that we initiated a while ago is starting to trace the results of our work so that there's a story to tell there. And so there's a sense of satisfaction, I think, that we all ought to have about the work that we're doing here. It is respected, and we do it a bit more quietly than some other parts of ICANN's operation, and that's just fine with me. So let me thank you all, and this brings this meeting to a close. Don't be bashful about feedback, and we'll see you all in Cartagena, although we'll see some of you in Maastricht. And I guess we should say we are trying to plan a meeting nominally on Wednesday at dinner time at the IETF in Maastricht. We squeeze these meetings in the middle of their very packed agenda, take advantage, as I said, of the fact that there's an aggregation of people who are in the area and we'll run another hybrid meeting. Thank you.